Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never. And why do I say that? Why do I say what we call the obligatories? The intent is to help motivate and help people start actualizing where we are as a nation, where we are as Christians historically. There's this biblical term, the great and dreadful days of the Lord. So I am only trying to help motivate people to actually take a step and just take a stand and not allow government to push us any further outside the boundaries of the Constitution. And if we just start taking a stand, we start pushing back and demanding compliance, we will have our liberties restored, and we will actually, I'll just say this, what America would have to go through as the world dives into global communism and moves forward under the, you know, those revelations provided for these days, I believe America would not have to endure nearly as much as the rest of the world. We have an opportunity, folks. It's now or never. And this is why we have the obligatories of appealing to heaven, learn, pray, and act. And why I tell you that that debt is fraud. We don't owe that. And as I basically say, the center of doing all of this is all about demanding full compliance to the Constitution. And in so doing that, then we will actually have the federal government and our state government and our county government no longer spending us into oblivion. And actually, we need to hold them fully accountable so that these people who we can't trust anymore can never get into a position of public service. I say it all the time. The good Lord gave us everything we need in that Constitution to actually make this a reality. So, welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
I always try to come up with a new way of saying the obligatories, but I realize that at some points in time, people don't. Why does he say it's now or never? What is this debt is fraud stuff? And so if you've been listening for a long time, I dive into the debt. I dive into the appeals. I dive into all of these little things. So anyway, and by the way, folks, the podcast or this show is actually hosted on Reclaiming the Republic. And actually, if you go to reclaimingtherepublic.org, at the very right, on the right-hand side is the site menu. Just go down to the Red State Talk Radio Podcasts, and that's where you'll find the current year's podcast. The podcast archives is where you'll find all the previous years. By all means, many of them are doozies, and maybe every once in a while there's a flub or a flat or what have you. But anyway, we're not here to entertain. We're not here to give you the pornographic cycle of news. What's going on here? What's going on there? Because those are the distractions. We're here to empower you with the actual words of what this Constitution means. And we're in the golden days of the year where we're actually covering the framers actually telling us what that Constitution means. We've covered Pennsylvania. We're in the final throes of Massachusetts. And so, actually, we're on February 1st, Mr. Bowdoin, and this is where we're talking about a republic versus a monarchy. And some of the comments that are going to be coming up are going to be very enlightening, and I think you're going to see that spiritual view of the Constitution as we kind of wrap this up. So anyway, let's go ahead and dive into what Mr. Bowdoin says regarding this form of government. Go ahead.
All right. As the particular state governments are relative to the manners and genius of the inhabitants of each state, so ought the general government to be an assemblage of the principles of all the governments, for without this assemblage of the principles, the general government will not sufficiently apply to the genius of the people confederated, and therefore by its meeting and its operation with a continual opposition through this circumstance, it must necessarily fail in its execution, because agreeably to the idea of Salon, is that how you say that?
Yeah, Salon. Uh-huh.
Okay. The people would not bear it. It may not, therefore, be improper to examine whether the federal constitution proposed has a likeness to the different state constitutions, and such alone as to give the spirit of features of the particular governments. For Baron Montesquieu observes that all governments ought to be relative to their particular principles, and that a confederative government ought to be composed of states of the same nature, especially of the republican kind, and instances that, as the spirit of monarchy is war and enlargement of dominion, peace and moderation are the spirit of a republic. These two kinds of government cannot naturally subsist in a confederate republic.
Okay, so, and he's using the word confederate. In other words, many of the men in the time, even Thomas Jefferson, looked at the republic as a confederation, and as a matter of fact, when he was a president, he actually referred to the Union as a confederacy. He didn't refer to it as a federation, because the concept was that there was very limited powers delegated, and the residual mass, he even brings this up in the 1798 Kentucky resolutions, that the residual mass that of powers not delegated were left to the states, which means the majority of all things to be done would be done by the states. So he goes on and on and on, and then we actually have him dive into some legislative powers of the executive are negative, right? The legislative powers of the executive are negative. In other words, they can't create law, and he's going to dive into what this means. So go ahead.
Okay. The legislative powers of the president are precisely those of the governors of this state and those of New York, rather negative than positive powers, given with a view to secure the independence of the executive and to preserve a uniformity in the laws which are committed to them to execute. The executive powers of the president are very similar to those of the several states, except in those points which relate more particularly to the Union and respect ambassadors, public ministers, and consuls. Of the genius of the people of the states as expressed by their different constitutions of government, if the similarity of each and the general spirit of governments concur to point out the policy of a confederate government, by comparing the federal constitution with those of the several states, can we expect one more applicable to the people, to the different states, and to the purposes of the Union than the one proposed, unless it should be contended that a Union was unnecessary? If a republic is small, says Baron Montesquieu, it is destroyed by a foreign force. If it is large, it is ruined by an internal imperfection.
Okay, so he goes through this Latin phrase of fatio potentia suave nixie, and so just to try to help out. So Montesquieu was cited during the convention. He's cited in the Federalist Papers and in the ratification debates, because he became the subject matter expert in analyzing republics. At least so the men of these days thought. Montesquieu never fathomed a multi-tiered republican form of government. So the reason I'm kind of barging in here is to help set this understanding. When they talk about Montesquieu, they just talk about the single republic here being created as the Union, but ultimately, each of the states really moved more away from, you know, their monarchical theocracy, because technically they weren't monarchs. Let me change that. Republican theocracy. Because each of the states, at least eight of the states, had hard-coded religious affiliations and involvement, which means that it was more of a theocracy, even though they didn't preach, and the I'll just say the priesthoods of these different faiths did not have, you know, political ties, but they did live and imbue the doctrines of the faith. And so they were probably more theocratic, and they were also somewhat Republican. What ended up happening as this new constitution moved forward, it inspired the rest of the states to actually align itself like the federal republic, and created their own republic and creating bicameral legislative bodies. Every state legislature was reframed into bicameral legislative bodies. It wasn't until the 17th Amendment when Nebraska abandoned it. So the point is that as these states started creating a model that followed the federal Republican form of government, of a limited and defined state government, and basically created these counties and, you know, made this, I'll just say, this tied legislation. Because you got to remember, folks, in these days, they never imagined state would take care of, you know, your welfare. They would, you know, educate you. These were all things that were left to the church and or to the people to take care of themselves. They weren't the ultimate answer in all things. Communism was not embraced, and as a matter of fact, it was actually shrugged. These men understood the principles of the modern-day communism as it had occurred in the past, of how socialism and or statism, where the state controlled everything, was actually a destructive form of government, which is why they left. And it's harmful to the individual liberties as well. Statist government is harmful to the individual liberties. So he's going through this Montesquieu paradigm, but I'm just trying to make sure you understand that as he's kind of citing this, that a small republic is, you know, is attacked and defeated, a large republic is defeated within, well, we actually have a three-tiered, and there's these relationships. And even though the larger republic is failing because the states aren't holding it accountable, and the states are failing because the counties aren't holding it accountable, I hope that by going through this and by this little interruption, you can start fathoming, you can start placing context to the importance of getting your counties right by creating constitutions, by demanding full compliance and moving that across the counties within your state, to then get your state to become accountable, where the state will actually start working with the other states as republics within the national republic to actually clean up their act and get all of the states cleaned up and demanding the federal republic get its you-know-what together. So anyway, go ahead. And if mankind.
Okay. And if mankind had not contributed, hold on.
Contrived.
I have an echo, which is throwing me off.
Okay.
There we go. And if mankind had not contrived a confederate republic, says the same author, a constitution that has all the internal advantages of a republican and the external force of a monarchical government, they would probably have always lived under the tyranny of a single person. Admitting this principle of Baron Montesquieu, the several states are either too small to be defended against a foreign enemy or too large for republican constitutions of government. If we apply the first position to the different states, which reason and the experience of the late war point out to be true, a confederate government is necessary. But if we admit the latter position, then the several governments, being in their own nature imperfect, will be necessarily destroyed from their being too extensive for republican governments.
Okay.
From whence it follows, if the foregoing principles are true, that we ought to adopt a confederation, presuming the different states well calculated for republican governmental, for if they are not, their corruption will work their destruction separately, and if they are designed for destruction from their natural imperfection, it will certainly be more advantageous to have them destroyed collectively than separately, as in the case we shall fall under one great national government. But if the advantages of a confederacy admitting the principles of it to be good are duly considered, that is, will give security and permanency to the several states, not only against internal disputes, but wars with one another, if the wars in Europe arising from jarring and opposing interests are a public calamity, if it is for the benefit of ourselves and future generations to prevent their horrid devastations on this continent. To secure the states against such calamities, it will be necessary to establish a general government to adjust the disputes and to settle the differences between state and state. For without a confederacy, the several states being distinct sovereignties would be in a state of nature with respect to each other, and the law of nature, which is in the right of the strongest, would determine the disputes that might arise. To prevent the operation of so unjust a title, to afford protection to the weakest state against the strongest, to secure the rights of all against the encroachments of any of the states, to balance the powers of all the states, by each giving up a portion of its sovereignty, and thereby better to secure the remainder of it, are amongst the main objects of a confederacy.
Okay, so right there, folks, when you read this, and if you read this again, Tammy, instead of saying states, say counties in your head.
Okay.
No, I'm not going to have you do it now, but if you realize what he was just saying, that you're creating these confederations where you have a limited general government and the residual mass of powers is left to that sub-government. And in this case, he's talking states. But when we create a state government, which should be a general government that serves the counties, the same thing would be applicable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Where there needs to be a protection of the weakest county against the strongest to secure the rights of all against the encroachments of any of the counties, to balance the powers of all the counties by each giving up a portion of its sovereignty, and thereby better to secure the remainder of it, are among the main objects of a confederacy. So he's pointing out how, this Constitution literally did create the model of how the states needed to reform themselves. Instead of, and you've heard me say this before, that the framers in the Constitutional Convention dared not walk down the path of trying to dictate how the states needed to form their governments. They wanted the states to come to those conclusions on their own. And nothing better than this divine inspiration of literally giving the states a perfect model of how to create a form of government, a republican form of government that had checks and balances, protected the individual rights as well as the individual sovereignties within the republic. And so I'll kind of yield at this point. I think I've made my point that when we start looking at this description of good, sound republics, that's how the states eventually, but see, nobody ever said that this is what they were doing. I think, and forgive the expression, they fell back assward into, making their states better by following what they may not have understood in the federal constitution, but it just seemed to work and everybody kind of liked it and they applied it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
But they didn't.
Yeah.
They didn't understand. I mean, one of the best forms of flattery is when somebody copies you, right? When somebody plagiarizes, when somebody basically follows you, does what you do. And so there's nothing more obvious than the fact that every state actually did try to follow the federal constitution. Not only that, But this government, the U.S. government, actually shared, and many of the nations of the world asked for our Constitution because they wanted to emulate it. The problem was they couldn't, because they were even farther from the kitchen to understand how that goulash was made, what's in it, what do these things mean. So anyway, let's keep going. I'm sorry.
Okay. But the advantages of a union of the states are not confined to mere safety from within or without. They extend not only to the welfare of each state, but even to the interest of each individual of the states.
And same thing applying with counties there. So, okay. So the Honorable Mr. Samuel Adams now comes to this next assertion. This is interesting. Go ahead.
As your Excellency was pleased yesterday to offer for the confederation of this convention certain propositions intended to accompany the ratification of the Constitution before us, I did myself the honor to bring them forward by a regular motion, not only from the respect due to your Excellency, but from a clear conviction in my own mind that they would tend to affect the salutary and important purpose which you had in view, the removing the fears and quieting the apprehensions of many of the good people of this commonwealth, and the mere effectually guarding, and the more effectually guarding against an undue administration of the federal government. I beg leave, sir, more particularly to consider those propositions, and in a very few words to express my own opinion that they must have a strong tendency to ease the minds of gentlemen who wish for the immediate operation of some essential parts of the proposed Constitution, as well as the most speedy and effectual means of obtaining alterations in some other parts of it, which they are solicitous should be made. I will not repeat the reasons I offered when the motion was made, which convinced me that the measure now under consideration will have a more speedy, as well as a more certain influence in effecting the purpose last mentioned than the measure proposed in the Constitution before us.
Okay.
Your Excellency's first proposition is that it be explicitly declared that all powers not expressly delegated to the Congress are reserved to the several states to be by them exercised. This appears to my mind to be a summary of a bill of rights which gentlemen are anxious to obtain. It removes a doubt which many have entertained respecting the matter, and gives assurance that if any law made by the federal government shall be extended beyond the power granted by the proposed Constitution, and inconsistent with the Constitution of this state, it will be an error and adjudged by the courts of law to be void. It is consonant with the second article in the present Confederation that each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. I have long considered the watchfulness of the people over the conduct of their rulers the strongest guard against the encroachments of power, and I hope the people of this country will always be thus watchful.
Okay, so the point here, as we look at this, it is so actually we've read the Articles of Confederation, and it actually did have that language in it where there was this limitation of power. The wording was not added to the Constitution, because the Constitution streamlined the Articles of Confederation, specifying very, very defined roles and responsibilities. There were ambiguities in the Articles of Confederation regarding tribunals and what they would do, because they had the ultimate authority of regulating themselves, because the Continental Congress was a single sovereignty. And by breaking it up, it literally laid out and defined how the executive and what the only things the executive could do, where those were more ambiguous in the articles. The same thing with the judiciary and so forth. We're going into break. So when we come back, I'll kind of wrap this up so we can move forward. And as you can see, Samuel Adams is now really becoming more of a proponent in trying to drive these amendments and see this Constitution ratified. Even though he didn't feel like he wanted to participate, he now sees the exigencies in this Constitution being ratified. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so to further explain this one part, because he starts off talking about Your Excellency's first proposition, and basically he's reading the 10th Amendment, or what we have ratified as the 10th Amendment, that powers not expressly delegated are, you know, reserved, expressly delegated to Congress or the federal government, are basically reserved to the several states. So in other words, he refers to this as a Bill of Rights. Now, I don't know how well, because as we went through this, I thought it was done pretty good, that those things not enumerated, they couldn't meddle with. And I believe they even covered the fact that it would be folly to try to list everything. But the 10th Amendment did come across as a no-brainer. In other words, do you really need to protect religion? Do you need to protect speech and, you know, the expression thereof, the right of petition, those types of things? I think the right of petition and assembly probably needed to be mentioned and or protected in a Bill of Rights. But technically, the Bill of Rights became more harmful than anything else, because people were more focused on the Bill of Rights because they were far more sanctimonious in their minds than the rest of the Constitution, when, in fact, had they never passed the Bill of Rights and they focused on what powers were delegated, it would be constantly argued, hey, that's not expressly delegated. Because as the ratification debates stated, it needed to be expressly delegated. They went through the ambiguity of this General Defense and Welfare Clause, that it really was not delegating powers, which is why there were an enumeration of powers that followed it. It was a preamble to help explain why these powers following were delegated. And then at the end of Article 1, Section 8, the Necessary and Proper Clause to carry forward the execution of the foregoing powers clearly was not giving them a blank check to do and create any kind of power or any kind of law that they felt necessary and proper beyond the aforegoing powers. Because it was quickly implied by Hamilton that the Necessary and Proper Clause could lend to implied powers. And it was expressly shut down in the debates that there were no implications. The powers were clearly enumerated, and the laws that they would create would be directly derived from those enumerations, not something implied or contrived. So anyway, so as he's going through this, he points out at the very end of this that it is consonant with the second article in the present Confederation that each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right, which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States in Congress assembled. what I'm basically, and the reason why that line is so important, folks, is because this speaks to the equal footing of the states. There's nowhere in the U.S. Constitution that says one state would have diminished sovereignty. As a matter of fact, we covered the notes, Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. It was clear that they wanted to do that. They originally went down that path, and then they changed it to basically allow the federal government, while the land was territory, they could create the rules, the necessary rules and regulations in the transition. But once that state joined the Union, it was a full sovereign state with its freedoms and independence, power and jurisdiction, and all rights that other states enjoyed. And that was not the case. It's slowly, but if you look at 200, almost 300 years, it kind of quickly happened because it was right there. You know, how far removed is 1826? It's 18 years, right? 18 years from when the federal government was formed, 18 years when they started meddling with the sovereignty of the states joining the Union, i.e. Indiana, where they basically said, yeah, you're not going to be able to get all this land, and we're going to dictate what you're going to do with some of this. And that was the first encroachment. So as Adams talks about, he says, I have long considered the watchfulness of the people over the conduct of their rulers and the strongest guard against the encroachments of power, and I hope this country the same. Because he was referring to the Bill of Rights being that process or that mechanism of that watchfulness. And my point is that because everybody was so focused on the Bill of Rights, nobody cared about Article 4, Section 3 of the Admission of States. Because had they, the people in Indiana, instead of being focused, well, they're not stepping on our rights of religious expression and all these other things, you know, I guess Congress can go ahead and do what they're doing, because they weren't reading Article 4, Section 3, where the federal government could not diminish or make any insinuations that they had to do anything with their property. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is why when we look at the Bill of Rights, the Bill of Rights, I believe, was divinely inspired by James Madison, not for the immediate time. And so it was going to be problematic because the states would start losing sight. But I believe that the good Lord knew that if there wasn't a Bill of Rights passed at this point in time, that as the Union progressed, as they moved closer and closer towards the volatility of slavery and abolition within the Union, and this dichotomy, this diametrically opposed positions of, you know, slavery and abolition. The point is this, is that there was probably no way they would have been able to actually muster a Bill of Rights at that point in time to help protect the people of the states. I don't know if that makes sense. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Because the 14th Amendment basically took all the privileges and immunities guaranteed under the U.S. Constitution and applied it, because that's what the privileges and immunities, that wasn't, had nothing to do with the Comity Clause. It had everything to do with the Bill of Rights, because most people say, well, when you actually read the debates, there was no connection only to the Comity Clause. The Comity Clause is in Article 4, Section, well, I'm going to read it for you because, you know, it's important that we do this. Article 4, I think it's Section 2. Yes. The citizens of each state shall be entitled to all privileges and immunities of citizens of the several states, where that basically kind of applied a comity amongst the states. But the federal government, you know, had no involvement in privileges and immunities over the citizens other than the jurisdiction of crime. Until the Bill of Rights, they only had the jurisdiction of crime over treason, counterfeiting, crimes committed against the, you know, laws of nations, and crimes committed on the high seas, crimes and felonies committed on the high seas, whatever. Those four laws, those four types of crimes. That was it. In other words, the federal government had no interaction on a day-to-day basis with the people. It was strictly dealing with the state governments and administering its taxation by apportionment to each of the state legislatures. So when the Civil War kicked off and all these states basically seceded from the Union, the need for protecting the freemen, as if the states actually rejoined the Union, the one thing that the radical Republicans were wrong with was the fact that even though they ended slavery and they created the Freedmen's Bureau, they had to make it so that the states had to join the Union, right? Because technically, they were asserting this authority over slavery, because the Civil War ended slavery. And they were asserting this authority over these 13 sovereign states, or however many, 11, I think it was 11, these 11 sovereign states that seceded from the Union. They left Congress. They basically were no longer a part of the Union. So now we were meddling in the affairs of these independent states. So they had to bring them back in, or eventually they would have to cut these states free. Right? They couldn't rule them, because the Constitution really didn't even allow that. It only allowed, based on the Monroe Doctrine, the ability to protect its interests from this evil foreign influence, such as the slave trade coming in from other states and so forth. So bottom line, Section 4 of the 14th Amendment was that great enticement that forced these states to actually have to come back, which was the debt. Every single one of these states was taking on a debt as a part of the Confederation, that they were all going to share this debt that they were racking up with England. And so they either had to pay that debt, or they had that debt expunged by joining the Union under the 14th Amendment. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So in other words, the brilliance of what the federal government was doing to kind of cover its tracks and to force the states to have, you know, the motivation in coming back. Well, you know, there's a good likelihood that some of the states may have not have ever came back, like Texas and so forth. However, they wanted that protection, so that's why they came back. But there was no language in the 14th Amendment that subjugated any state to say you could no longer leave after this. Right? The states could come back, and if they felt the federal government started violating the Constitution in any way, applying tyranny upon the states at any point in time, because Madison, we've covered this several times in several years, that under the Kentucky and Virginia resolution, states could clearly secede from the Union, and they could nullify those laws and say, we're not going to have any part of this Union. Your federal laws are no longer applicable in this state. We're an independent and sovereign state again. So at any point in time, they could actually leave. States can leave the Union. So they could have come back in, expunged the debt, and when the federal government started violating and I'll give you a good case in point, when the Jim Crow laws were being applied because of Plessy v. Ferguson, separate but equal, and those types of things, northern states could have actually seceded from the Union to say, hey, we consider that, you know, an abomination, and you're violating the actual definitions and the terms as explained in the debates in Congress, that separate but equal and equal protection under the laws, those types of things were being violated by the separate but equal policy, and how the Jim Crow laws was literally taking away the privileges and immunities of these citizens. They could have easily left the Union at that point. The southern states, because it favored their paradigm in being able to try to oppress blacks, because they were still, this goes back to, you know, we could see how long do you think it took for the southern states to change their attitude regarding the Civil War and slavery? Because when you ended slavery, because of the Civil War, did that instantly change everybody's minds that it was wrong? No. What you did was you used force to say you can't do it anymore. And because we're so much more powerful than you, we're not letting you do it anymore. So while they basically kept their jackbooted thug, you know, heels on the necks of the southern states, how long do you think it took? Well, instead of convincing the southern states, they empowered and enabled bad behavior by giving them the ability to then oppress. This was done to basically create a more divisive, you know, I'll just say more of divisive measures within the Union as we move forward, because we literally started moving down more of the racial divide because it was forced upon the blacks. In other words, the blacks were being oppressed and the white established government was doing these things. Am I making my point? So I'm trying to help lay out this concept of what was really happening. And all of this was, again, influenced by England, because it wasn't until the Organic Act, when England was able to, you know, infiltrate us to successfully influence those who were making the laws to start creating policies and redefining the Constitution and so forth, because that they wanted to divide us and conquer us. England, mm-hmm. just like the southern states, never liked being forced to not have their, you know, their slavery. England did not like to be, they did not like the fact that we forced our independence upon them, and they dreaded the idea that we got away, and they never forgot. Still to this day, mm-hmm. those of Britain, those of, you know, born there and what have you, they still have this in their craw. Yeah, you guys think you're independent or what have you. They're very jealous. And even though nobody really understands the world conspiracies that are really happening under the, under the visible part of our government, the reality is that Britain deliberately started undermining and getting the federal government to go sideways in doing all sorts of things that were unconstitutional. And this concept, this goes back to the Bill of Rights. The concept of, you know, well, as long as they're not touching our religion. Well, that actually happened in 1920. It took a while where the Bill of Rights really started affecting white people. But black people were having their rights, and there weren't a lot of people within the establishment, and currently the majority of people in government were white. So, in other words, most people were just either, oh, that's too bad, or just take... There were white folks that were constantly fighting for the plight of the freedmen, blacks in America, and so forth, obviously, because even during the tensions of the civil rights era of the 1950s and 60s and so forth, there were lots of whites that were supporting it. But so bottom line, as we kind of watch these paradigms and we see, you know, the paradigm of Britain and the paradigm of blacks and minorities in this divisive America that was created all unconstitutionally, the reason America was, you know, didn't know what to do and how to deal with this is because of the Bill of Rights. Because we never taught ourselves to look at the federal government by its enumerated objects in the Constitution. The Bill of Rights were just declaratory clauses to, you know, they can't go there. The fact is, they couldn't go anywhere other than those enumerated objects. So you got to focus on the Constitution. The Bill of Rights is not as important. It was only important when all of a sudden we started turning our backs on the privileges and immunities of certain demographics, whether that be women, whether that be minorities of any race and kind, if that makes sense. And so mm-hmm. this is why I constantly, you know, it's not that I don't see the value of the Bill of Rights. I saw the Bill of Rights as the big distraction that people just focused, and that was their beloved part of the Constitution. instead of looking at the actual compact and understanding all seven articles. So I will stop myself. I pulled myself out of the rat hole and we're moving on and back to the Massachusetts debates. My point is, and again it is, that here Samuel Adams was arguing for this. And again, at their time, they had an affinity for the glorious Bill of Rights, and they felt lost moving under this newfangled Constitution, this inspired document by the divine hand of providence. They felt, we have to have, it's kind of like Israel after 400 years of being free of, you know, despotism by the rule of judges. We got to have a king. Everybody has a king. We need a king to make us feel better. And our king's better than your king. And they turned their backs and went down a new form of governing where Israel was basically just, you know, went sideways from there. And it's the same thing. I see the Bill of Rights as that same thing. Go ahead.
Another of your excellency's propositions is calculated to the quiet the apprehensions of gentlemen, lest Congress should exercise an unreasonable control over the state legislatures with regard to the time, place, and manner of holding elections, which by the fourth section of the first article are to be prescribed in each state by the legislature thereof, subject to the control of Congress. I have had my fears lest this control should infringe the freedoms of elections, which ought ever to be held sacred. Gentlemen who have objected to this controlling power in Congress have expressed their wishes that it had been restricted to such states as many neglect or refuse that power vested in them, and to be exercised by them if they please. Your Excellency proposes, in substance, the same restriction which I should think cannot but meet with their full approbation. The power to be given to Congress to lay and collect taxes, duties, imposts, and excises has alarmed the minds of some gentlemen. They tell you, sir, that the exercise of the power of laying and collecting direct taxes might greatly distress the several states and render them incapable of raising monies for the payment of their respective state debts or for any purpose. They say the imposts and excise may be made adequate to the public emergencies in the time of peace, and ask why the laying direct taxes may not be confined to a time of war. You are pleased to propose to us that it be a recommendation that Congress do not lay direct taxes, but when the monies arising from the imposts and excise shall be insufficient for the public exigencies, the prospect of approaching war might necessarily create an expense beyond the productions of imposts and excise. How, then, would the government have the necessary means of providing for the public defense? Must they not have recourse to other resources besides imposts and excise? The people, while they watch for their own safety, must and will have a just confidence in the legislature of their own election. The approach of war is seldom, if ever, without observation. It is generally observed by the people at large, and I believe no legislature of a free country would venture a measure which should directly touch the purses of the people under a mere pretense, or unless they could show to the people's satisfaction that there had been, in fact, a real public exigency to justify it.
Okay, so here he's throwing this, and there was this quote here that this is the quote that Samuel Adams was quoting the amendment that came from John Hancock. Quote, Congress do not lay direct taxes, but when the monies arising from imposts and excises shall be insufficient for the public exigencies, close quote. And so he expounded on that concept. And reality, there you go. That's probably exactly the amendment that should have been inserted, right? Because I think everybody would agree that the federal government doesn't require a lot of money. Things may have changed from then to now. The federal government seems to actually make a lot of money from imposts coming in. In other words, trade coming in. Why don't they have imposts on trade coming in? Or why is it that everybody wants? Because I don't know if you follow economists. Economists want to make sure that everything comes in equally.
Mm-hmm.
And what I mean by that is that as we have trade with China, we have trade with Japan, we have trade with states in Europe, and the states in Europe have a value-added tax. They have this VAT. And so there is other taxes outside of the VAT, the EU VAT, that each nation actually places on the exports that go out. So that this is how they make money to fund their statist government. Most of the nations of Europe, you know, mandate holidays, you know, 1 month holidays and these types of things where, you know, the life and the quality of life in Europe is better than they can afford.
Mm-hmm.
And as long as people buy their crap with all of this added tax, where America doesn't address those things, we just pay it, then that's not free trade. Because free trade is actually buying something at its real cost instead of the subsidies that the government puts upon those things so that it is adjusted to the government's needs, not the true product cost. Same thing with China. China is very, and Japan, they're all statist governments, or there's always this government involvement that subsidizes and pays for the holidays, the benefits of the people. All of these things are heavily subsidized. There's no such thing as a free market in any nation in the world where we tried to do this, and the federal government started actually usurping the markets and everything else. But the bottom line is, we can't have a free trade because there's no nation out there that's literally giving us a service at its cost. Or I should say, what it is putting on for profit. In other words, there's hidden within the cost of what we pay for that isn't profit for the company to make money. It is government subsidies behind it, which means that that's not free. It's not free market. It's not freely produced.
No kidding.
Okay, so when we look at the free trade, there's no doubt in my mind that as long as we actually countered their products so that, you know, they wouldn't be able to sell those things. In other words, we raised the price of those products coming in to help subsidize our products because that's what they do.
Mm-hmm.
They make their money off of their imports and their imposts that they put on our products and everybody else's products. So it becomes this, and I don't know why economists don't actually lay it all out there. I don't think there is a way. We're running out of time. The show's over. But
okay.
For the most part, I look at what's going on, and it is nothing to do with free market. It's nothing to do with the Constitution, the ways it's designed. And we have failed to actually protect our commerce from the foreign commerce and these foreign alliances of, you know, statist governments, communism, and so forth. So all that being said, folks, these ratification debates really highlight a lot of points that are actually very savory. I'm J.R. Mobley, Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.